Good evening, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com.
Today's show is sponsored by Austria's Finest Naturally Authentic Pumpkin Seeds and Pumpkin Seed Oil from the Steiermark, available at organicuniverse.com. Listeners of The Organic View can receive $1 off their purchase by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW.
For other promotional offers, please visit TheOrganicView.com's website.
As we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, which is the only radio show focused on the impact of neonicotinoids, my special guest co-host Tom Theobald and I will be discussing this week's news. Tonight, some of the things that we're going to discuss include the USDA's listening session, a recent workshop put on by the Xerxes Society for Pollinators, and HR 1422, and one other very interesting subject, which is neonicotinoids in Australia. So I'd like to first welcome to the show Tom Theobald. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, Dylan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tom, could you just share with our listeners a little bit about yourself for those that are not familiar with you?
Sure. I'm a small-scale commercial beekeeper. This is my 39th year concluding right now, and I was the president of the Boulder County Beekeepers Association for 30 years, and I've been active in many of these issues and have spoken out frequently.
Thanks, Tom. Now, the past week, actually, there were two major conference calls that were created to discuss efforts to help pollinators. One was hosted earlier by the EPA, and then this last one was hosted by USDA. Now, it was quite interesting because we heard quite a mix of different perspectives and opinions and experiences. Tom, what is your take on this call?
On the listening session?
Yes. Did you get anything out of it?
Well, yes, I did. The first one was conducted by the EPA, and it had terrible technical problems. There was background noise. People couldn't hear. The people who were on the internet, and I was one of them, could neither hear nor see any of the presentations. And the only thing we were privy to was the chat line, the texting between the people who were there and on the internet. And from that standpoint, it was a total disaster. And the same thing happened a year ago when the EPA did a conference like this, and you have to wonder if this is an intentional incompetence designed to stifle discussion. This is the second time. You would think they would be more competent than this. The USDA one was better, and the sound quality was good, and you could hear the speakers. And the curious thing about the USDA listening session, these listening sessions are supposedly the outgrowth of the presidential proclamation calling for a task force to review the neonicotinoid issues. And this was presented with a great deal of fanfare and touted as a listening session. And you would expect that they would expect to hear some important testimony. But at the end, someone asked if it was going to be recorded, and the answer was no. It seems odd that they would go to all this effort and not record what was apparently very important testimony. We've been treated like this for many, many years, and as a consequence, we're very suspicious of any of their activities, and it just seems odd that they wouldn't record a session like this.
Well, you would think with all the controversy surrounding the decision whether or not they should follow the European lead and push through a ban on some of the neonicotinoids being used here in America, I agree. It should have been recorded.
Now, there was some good testimony, though.
Yeah.
There were a number of people who spoke on behalf of the bees and the beekeepers and outlined some of the problems that we're facing, and there was some good information presented.
Now, was there any talk about the recent findings by EPA in regards to neonicotinoids in soybeans?
I don't recall if that was specifically addressed or not, but you, for the listeners, you might just review what that was.
Well, I don't have it in front of me, but recently the EPA made an announcement that they found that neonicotinoids provided, I don't believe it, they found that it provided any value to soybeans. And
yeah, they found virtually no benefit in yield from the use of the neonicotinoid seed treatments.
Now, what was interesting, Tom, was there was somebody who participated in one of the conferences. I don't remember, the discussions. I don't remember if it was the EPA's discussion or if it was USDA, but this gentleman was a farmer who grew soybeans and was actually in support of neonicotinoids.
Well, you know, the farmers have been sold a bill of goods, and they've been given a full court press as to how effective these products are, and they're paying a premium for the seed treatments, and the question is whether they're getting a return on their investment or not, and according to the EPA, they're not.
Now, what's interesting is that there's a lot of talk about creating habitat that's free from neonicotinoids and other systemic insecticides, but at this particular point, Tom, you're a very experienced beekeeper. Is that even possible?
It's an open question, and the evidence that we do have supports what we have learned about the neonicotinoid family from the very beginning, that they're water-soluble, they migrate readily with the groundwater, and they have half-lives of years. So they accumulate with successive uses, with successive plantings. And the USGS survey of 9 Midwestern watersheds found the neonicotinoids in every sample that they took and at killing levels in some of those. So the question is, there's a great deal of talk about habitat improvement, and who could argue with habitat improvement, but the question is whether we even have habitat. It appears that most of the land in the United States, both farmland and urban and suburban land, has been seriously and heavily poisoned with these neonicotinoids, and I don't see any effort at all to try to understand that. If you plant, for example, if you were to plant highway margins with flowering plants that were attractive to the pollinators, and in fact the soil and the groundwater have been poisoned, and those plants draw up that poison, what you've created is not a refuge, not habitat. You've created an additional killing field, and you've aggravated the very problem that we're trying to deal with.
Now, it's kind of interesting. There's been a lot of talk about different solutions, from mowing the grass to just mowing down any type of flowering plants that will attract bees, especially if they're about to spray. And the thinking is that if you mow down these flowers that are attracting the pollinators, then it'll be a safer environment, I guess, to apply a treatment. The bottom line is, with neonicotinoids, the sublethal effects are really what I think a lot of people that are still thinking that this is a great solution don't really quite comprehend. And I really strongly feel that Dr. Hank Tanaka's research on the dose-time ratio It's something that has never been argued, and it's something that really cinches everything up when it comes to neonicotinoids, because the bottom line is, after a certain amount of time, once that dose has been reached, that's it. Game over.
And well, in some ways, this is the tobacco story all over again. One cigarette didn't kill people. And although there can be an acute kill from an exposure to these neonicotinoids, a large part of the effect is, as you say, sublethal. And if you add the element of time, there is no safe dose. It just takes a little more time to reach the same endpoint, which is death. And what they're trying to do is frighten us with the old chemicals. If you take the neonicotinoids away from us, we're going to go back to the old chemicals. Well, I've been around long enough that I lived through the era of the old chemicals.
Yeah.
And as nasty as they were, we survived them. Or most of the time we survived them, and even the longer lasting ones would have an effect for perhaps a week or two. We're talking about products now that have half-lives of years, and no dose is safe. The environment has been heavily poisoned with these, and there doesn't seem to be any interest in finding out to what degree.
Tom, could you please share with the listeners the study that you did that compares DDT to neonicotinoids, because I think that's really relevant. And for those of you that have not heard Tom talk about this or read it in, I think it's in two of the articles that I wrote that included Tom's study, I think it's really important.
Well, I'll try to do it as quickly as I can. Stories began to appear that compared the neonicotinoid family with DDT. The neonics, the new DDT, was one of the headlines. And it focused my attention a little bit, and I began to do a little digging and do a little research on what the use of DDT was. And the year of highest use was 1959, when 80 million pounds were applied. Now, they've tried to convince us that there are fewer pounds of pesticides being applied since the advent of genetically modified crops, and that, in fact, is not true, but what they conveniently overlook is the relative toxicity. So you have 80 million pounds of DDT in 1959, the year of its highest usage. The figures that we have for the neonicotinoids are 2013, 3.5 million pounds. Now, the neonicotinoids are 5,000 to 10,000 times more toxic than DDT. So that 3.5 million pounds represents a toxic equivalent of about 20 to 30 billion pounds of DDT. And I was reminded in the USDA listening session that 3.5 million pounds does not even account for the seed treatment, which is the major use of these neonicotinoids. 240 million acres planted to treated seed last year. So that 3.5 million pounds, that 20 to 30 billion pounds of toxic equivalents, is very, very conservative. It's almost beyond comprehension the level at which the environment has been poisoned.
Well, the bottom line is, every time they sell the GMO seeds, the companion technology with those GMO seeds is the neonicotinoids. So I don't know how they are going to continue to grow these GMO crops without the neonicotinoids. And furthermore, they're dumping tons of this stuff into the soil. What I'd like to see is research being conducted on the macro and microorganisms in the soil. Because the bottom line is, if you don't have good soil health, you're not going to be able to grow much of anything at all. And if you look at Dr. Tanaki's research, he made a reference to earthworms. And that's really powerful. As a master composter, we're always talking about just the sight of seeing the earthworms in your compost. It's a really good sign, especially for good, healthy soil. Well, if these chemicals are mobile in groundwater and they are going from one area to the other, what is that exactly doing to these organisms?
Well, there's some recent information that's come out of Saskatchewan, Dr. Christy Morrissey has been sampling the prairie pothole waters and has found that the neonicotinoid levels are very high, and even pre-planting, they're finding high levels of these neonicotinoids in the prairie potholes, which means that it's the carryover from the previous year. These have had a very detrimental effect on freshwater invertebrates, which are at the base of the food chain. And if it's happening on the prairies of Saskatchewan, it's most certainly happening in the cornfields of Iowa and the Dakotas and Minnesota and everywhere else.
Tom, could you explain to our listeners that are not familiar with how honeybees forage, why these little pockets of water are so critical?
Well, everything needs water for life, and if the water source is contaminated, there are many, many life forms that are affected by that. I mean, the folklore of Western expansion was the poisoned water hole with all the dead cattle skeletons around it. And it's not quite that dramatic, quite that obvious. Well, maybe it is quite that dramatic, but that's in effect what apparently has been done. We have poisoned the soil and we have poisoned the water. And honeybees take water just like any other organism. And in fact, they take large quantities of water during the summer, the hot summer months. And a good portion of the field force is diverted on those hot summer days to just bringing in water, carrying water back to the hive. They use it both for drinking and for cooling the hive.
Thanks, Tom. The next thing that I'd like to talk about is the recent pollinator conference. It was actually a workshop that I attended recently that was conducted by the Xerxes Society. I thought it was a great workshop. They provided a lot of wonderful information that you don't really consider when it comes to protecting pollinators, such as something as simple as raking your leaves. Because often some of these species will, take refuge in those leaves and overwinter. So that was, it was quite beneficial. Plus, just a little bit of information that was given about identifying different pollinators. For example, one of the things that I got a kick out of was identifying or telling the difference between a fly and a bee. There was a couple of books that were shown where the book jacket actually had a picture of a fly, even though it was supposed to be about honeybees or bees in general. I don't know the names of the books offhand, but I thought that was quite interesting. What I was disappointed in was the fact that GMOs were not addressed, and also the same rhetoric was given about neonicotinoids, that there isn't enough scientific information out there, and once again, if we don't use neonicotinoids, we're going to use something that's antiquated that's even worse, or we might wind up with something that's new that's worse. So,
it's a surprise to me to hear that, June, because obviously, I wasn't at the conference, but what you're saying is basically the corporate line, the corporate defense of these chemicals, and it just seems a little strange that the Xerxes Society would be repeating that without any kind of critical judgment.
Well, once again, I was disappointed in that, but I guess they are going to be as politically correct as possible, especially since they are, I guess they haven't taken a stand as far as supporting the ban in Europe or helping to support the any type of a ban here in the United States. So, as I said, that was disappointing. But when it comes to neonicotinoids in other parts of the world, there are people that are taking a stand. And actually, that brings us to the next topic, which is neonicotinoids in Australia. Tom, could you share with the listeners some of the correspondence that you've been receiving from one of our friends in Australia?
Yeah, I don't think I'll identify him because I don't want to draw any attention to him over there.
No, certainly not.
But one of the industry defenses has been that everything is just fine in Australia, and that's because they don't have varroa. Varroa has been the boogeyman in the industry's propagandizing. And so they've held up Australia as an example of the fact that the beekeepers can coexist with the neonicotinoids, and the reason is they don't have varroa. The industry line is it's varroa, varroa, varroa. Well, the reality is not quite what they would like us to believe. And Australia is a little different because it has huge areas of what they call bush. And the beekeepers prefer to be out in the bush. They don't have to deal with agricultural chemicals. And beekeepers like to be where they don't have too many close neighbors. So they have a great deal of bush available to them. But some of the beekeepers have been used to pollinate canola. And their experiences have been just the same as experiences around the world. They've seen horrible consequences, and this year was a little different in that Australia had a drought. It meant that the bush was not as attractive, and many more of the beekeepers moved into the canola fields and the areas where neonicotinoids were being used. And I received an email just within the past few days from our Australian correspondent telling me, Tom, it really looks bad here in Australia. We're seeing terrible losses, and they're doing everything they can to cover it up. It's a repeat of what we've seen, not only in the United States, but in many other countries.
Thanks, Tom. Now, the next subject, or next topic, should I say, is in regards to H.R. 1422. And this was just received yesterday, actually. And this, I do believe, is in Salon.com. And it says, House Republicans just passed a bill for forbidding scientists from advising the EPA on their own research. The reform measures make room for industry-funded experts on the EPA's advisory board.
Interesting, isn't that? Isn't it interesting how they would do that? This is how the chemical interests infiltrate the regulatory process. We had a similar effort several years ago called the Data Quality Act, which was a little two or three sentence addition to a financial bill of some kind. And basically what it required was absolutely perfect science to remove anything from the market when the science that is used to get these things on the market is very often junk. It's not science. It's not carefully evaluated by the EPA. And this H.R. 1422 is just another example of the chemical interests wheedling their way into the regulatory process. Scientists can't even advise the EPA on their own research, and yet more seats are made available to industry-funded experts. There's something seriously wrong here.
Now, according to the article, it says H.R. 1422, which passed 229-191, would shake up the EPA Scientific Advisory Board, placing restrictions on those pesky scientists and creating room for experts with overt financial ties to the industries affected by EPA regulations. The bill is being framed as a play for transparency. Rep. Michael Burgess, Republican Texas, argued that the board's current structure is problematic because it, quote, excludes industry experts, but not officials for environmental advocacy groups, end quote. The inclusion of industry experts, he said, would right this injustice. But the White House, which threatened to veto the bill, said it would, quote, negatively affect the appointment of experts and would weaken the scientific independence and integrity of the SAB, end quote. Now,
basically what they're saying is there's too much of their science and not enough of our science. Our science being the chemical interests, and the chemical interest science has been
well represented.
Junk.
Well, they're very well represented, but the bottom line is, when you look at the existing situation that we have, it's not working to begin with. So this is just baffling.
Well, industry wants no impediments whatsoever. I mean, any scrutiny of what they're doing is inconvenient for them.
Well, inconvenient is an understatement, but the bottom line is that things need to change. And granted, the existing processes are not working, but to further cripple them, I don't know if that's such a wise idea, but unfortunately, you know, the people really have to start speaking up about this. More and more people are learning about the impact of neonicotinoids and other things that are going on with the environment, and until people start speaking up, I don't see change happening. I think things have to get worse before they get better, Tom.
Well, you know, we were assured in the beginning that there would be no health problems, that these were comparatively safe for mammals, including humans. And just in the past week, a coalition of Canadian physicians has called for the banning of the neonicotinoids because of their concerns over the effects they have on human health.
Now, Tom, we have a question from someone that's in the chat room, and it's in regards to a new study. And it says 25 million GMO and pesticide safety study launched in London. Have you had a chance to review that, Tom?
I'm not sure what they are referring to.
That's something that perhaps we can continue the discussion next week. But,
sure.
Say
again, what was the subject?
I'm pulling it up. It says 25 million GMO and pesticide safety study launched in London. And it says the world's largest study on GMO and pesticide safety was launched by Factor GMO in London, UK, on Tuesday. And it says the Factor GMO study will investigate the health effects of a genetically modified crop that has been in our food and animal feed supplies for many years. It will answer the question, is this GMO food and associated pesticide, (glyphosate/Roundup) safe for human health? I mean, how many times do we have to look at different studies?
Well, the industry is going to keep us looking at it indefinitely until these chemicals have run out their useful life, and then they'll trot something else out.
Seralini's study was retracted, and industry knew that it would basically stifle their sales and increase bans around the world. But they managed to pull that study, which really shook up the scientific community. I mean, to retract a study after it's been published is just horrific. And
the legitimate scientists were outraged by what happened. But it's a primary example of the heavy-handedness of the industry in advancing their own interests.
Well, they're doing
the
same thing.
They have no interest in science.
Of course not. They have
science that supports what they want.
Exactly. And this is going to go on and on and on. And unfortunately, here in America, regardless of how much the advocates will push for a ban on these chemicals, until there is a massive demand for a ban like there is in Europe, I just don't see those changes happening, unfortunately. But, Tom, thank you so much for coming on and joining me tonight. We are out of time.
Thank you, too, June. I enjoyed the conversation.
Me, too, Tom. And thank you, everybody in the chat room that participated. And, folks, please tune in each week as Tom and I discuss the current issues that are that involve neonicotinoids and impact the environment. Have a great evening, everyone.